Well, welcome back to Coast, John Horst with us as we talk about cybersecurity. We'll take your questions and your stories. If you've ever been hacked or if anything strange has happened to you, share that with us when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, along with our special guest, John Horst. This hour, we're taking your phone calls, your questions, your stories, and maybe it's happened to you. How many people get hacked, John, and don't even know about it?
Oh, I would say probably on the order of hundreds of thousands. I think the biggest threat of being hacked and not knowing about it is your kids. Children are one of the probably the prime targets for identity theft because you don't really have any cause to check your child's credit record when they're small. And so a lot of times when a child becomes an adult and they go out and try to get a loan, all of a sudden they discover that someone else has been using their social security number, and it really becomes a mess, very difficult to clean that up. So that's one of the first things. It's just you if you're going to sign up for these services that monitor your credit and you have children, make sure you add your children to that service. And
that's a good point.
Make sure that you keep track of that so that you don't have surprises when they do turn 18.
I know someone whose little boy was on their computer, and you know, he was there all by himself playing around. The kid must have been about 10 years old, and up flashed on the computer, "Your computer is subject to a privacy invasion. Please call this toll-free number." So this little kid grabs the phone, calls this toll-free number, and there's some guy from Pakistan or India talking to him, trying to get information about the computer so this guy could hack into it. Unbelievable.
Yep. Yeah, yeah. It's kind of funny because I've gotten those calls. I've gotten those calls from India. Telling me that something's really bad happening to my computer and they need me to look in there so they can help. I drag those people out as long as I possibly can. I mean, I do. I'm like, really? Oh, how can you help me? You know, and I'll just milk it for all it's worth. I figure the longer that I can drag them out with me, that's less time that they have to actually.
What about the Nigerian scam, John? And let me ask you this. So you open up your email, and you get an email from someone that says, "Hi, I'm Princess Leia, and I've got $22 million that I must deposit in a U.S. bank account. I need your help." What happens when you email them back? I mean, they've already got your email address, obviously, because you've got the email.
Yeah, you email them back. They may try to, what they're going to do is they're going to try to put you in a position where you feel obligated to do something immediately. And that's your first step.
And most elderly people will fall for something like that.
Absolutely, yes. And one of the variants of this type of I was going to say hack or scam, is if they can get a hold of your contact list and figure out and impersonate somebody you know, impersonate a friend on Facebook.
Right.
And this will get really sophisticated. If they see that one of your friends on Facebook is out and about traveling overseas and they can impersonate that friend on email, then now you think, oh my God, yeah, I just saw on Facebook that they're overseas and now they got arrested and they need someone to help them bail them out. But it gets very sophisticated. Anytime you have someone say, you've got to do this right now, red flags ought to be going up.
Good point. Now, by simply re-emailing them back, though, doesn't open up your computer to anything, does it?
No. Sending them an email back would not open your computer up to anything. You would have to actually open an attachment of some sort. If you have a very old computer that you haven't been updating the operating system, you might open an HTML-based email and there may be some malicious code. But if your computer is relatively recent and it's getting its regular updates, that problem is pretty much been solved.
Why, if you open up an attachment, is that a problem?
If you open up an attachment, it could be like a a video file with a Trojan horse or some form of malware. And one of the more popular things that hackers do is they will insert what's called a keylogger program into what otherwise looks like a picture or a or a WAV file, a sound file, or a video. And so you execute that, and it piggybacks on the system's execution of the video, for example. It installs what's called a keylogger, and now when you go and you visit a bank, your bank's website, well, this keylogger is running in the background, and it's logging your keystrokes. And
everything you do, okay.
Oh, yeah, it knows your username and password because it's logging your keystrokes.
Well, I've noticed, too, that some banks will put in another layer between your username and password, some
right.
question about something. You know, what was right. your first car? What was your best friend? Another layer, I guess, for security purposes, right?
Yeah, it's supposedly for security purposes. It's not particularly effective when you do security questions because they can be easily guessed, especially from social media profiles. What is your mother's maiden name? Is one of the classics. And if you have family info on Facebook, somebody might be able to figure that out. And so what hackers will do is they'll try to get one piece of information from here, another from there, another from there, and before long, they've built up enough information about you that they can socially engineer their way into resetting your password and doing things like that.
Let's go to the phones. Tom is in Richland, Missouri, truck driving out there. Thomas, go ahead.
Hey, good evening, John. George, how you guys doing?
Good, John. Tom, thank you.
Hey, you were talking earlier about the collection of data and metadata for predicting future behaviors and events. It brought to mind Isaac Asimov's Foundation trilogy and how it was called psychohistory. The collection of all that data produced to not just predict, but to actually motivate or direct the behaviors of groups of people. Do you think that's possible, that they're not just trying to predict things, but actually use that? The whole process of it is you can predict what a group of people can do, but you'll never predict what one man will do.
Right, and then you have the whole mob mentality, where if you can get a group of people moving in a certain direction and sort of everyone looks at everyone else and says, oh, this must be what everyone's doing. And so absolutely, no, the more and more data that is out there, the more it becomes possible to run these statistical processes and figure out what motivates a certain group of people and then drop information into their Facebook feed and see what happens. And just little by little, you fine-tune your process. And I think it absolutely is possible to take all of this data out there and to do some pretty creepy things with it. We're only scratching the surface right now when we talk about this Facebook thing that we heard about today.
I think people like George Soros, who finance demonstrations and things like that, I think they use data like this all the time.
Oh, yeah. I'm quite sure they do.
Next up, we go to San Antonio, Texas. Manuel is with us, east of the Rockies. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, George. I really appreciate it. And I really appreciate you having John on. This is really important, and I hope a lot of people are listening to it.
Sure is.
Yeah. One question, I have several questions, but one of them is that when you go, like, let's say to the doctor's office or to the x-ray technicians or a specialty doctor, when they make you sign that HIPAA form, does that also give them the right to keep all the information that they've accumulated on you?
Okay, that is a bit of a unique situation because HIPAA is it's the health information protection and privacy, and it gives them permission to maintain electronic data records of your electronic health
records. It kind of exonerates them if they're hacked or something, right?
Well, yes and no. It does not give them the ability to sell it or make it available to other people.
Right, but I mean, if somebody hacks into their computers, they're not responsible, I guess.
If they are encrypting the information.
Okay.
In accordance with standard encryption and standard encryption standards advance over time, it's called an encryption safe harbor. If they are encrypting the data in accordance with up-to-date encryption standards, then if they get hacked, their liability is minimized. If they're not encrypting the data and they get hacked, their liability is wide open.
Well, let's go back to Manuel in San Antonio for his second question. Go ahead, sir.
Yeah, one more time, George. I'm sorry.
That's all right.
The other one that I had is that I went to the bank one time and just doing some regular transactions and stuff. And then I said, you know what? Go ahead and give me my list of all my activities and stuff for the month. And she went ahead and did it and says, oh, man, you're great. You only had so many transactions. Sometimes I stay here trying to print those out, and there's 50 pages of stuff. That's what you were saying about lessening your surface?
Yeah, absolutely.
That's exactly what you mean, right?
Yes, that is exactly what I mean. Now, when you said you had 50 pages of transactions, how long was that? For how long?
Oh, man.
Was that 1 month?
That was just for 1 month. She told me
that's a lot.
She told me, that this one person used their credit card so much that it ended up of almost 50 pages of information.
There must be debit cards.
Well, it's just one credit card because the bank gives you the cards, the cash cards, so that way you could use it as cash.
Yeah, it's like your ATM card.
ATM card or whatever. And then that also brought me to another question is, everybody complained that they didn't want to have the number branded on their skin. And then somebody said, it was on your program, George, said that they were going to put a chip in you.
They've been talking about chipping people and making all these things easier. I don't know if you've looked at that at all yet, John. Have you?
Yeah, I've read a little bit about that. Sure. Over my dead body, are they going to put a chip in me?
Exactly.
Oh,
I feel the
no.
same way. I also don't like driverless cars or trucks.
Oh, don't get me started.
And a driverless car just killed a woman in Arizona.
That is exactly right. Let's just go into that really quick. I'm a software engineer, cybersecurity guy. I come into cyber from a career writing software. Do you really want me making decisions about when you brake and when you turn while you're in that car and then discover that the car just hit somebody and killed her? Who's going to be held liable for that? Is the software developer going to be held liable? I kind of doubt it.
The owner of the car? Who?
Yeah. I am an ardent opponent of driverless vehicles. I don't want them on the streets in my neighborhood. Oh, no.
I agree with you. Plus, I don't want our truck drivers displaced from their jobs.
I agree with that, too. Yep. Absolutely.
Crazy. Next up, let's go to Joel in Miami, Florida. Hi, Joel. Go ahead.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
Good.
George, you said you grew up in Massachusetts, or was that just your mom?
My mom was born in Fitchburg, Massachusetts. I would go there every summer as a kid, but I was born in Detroit and lived there during most of my life.
I was. I'm from the Leominster, Fitchburg area.
Oh, yeah. My cousin still lives in Leominster.
Yeah. Well, anyways, let me get to my question to your guest. I'm building a large cryptocurrency mining operation using the graphics cards and whatnot, and I wanted to know if you had any advice that might be, a little above and beyond what people normally do that I might want to take advice from you on that situation. If you could help me with that, I'd appreciate it.
Yeah, a couple things. If you're going to go down that road, the graphic cards are okay, but there is a thing called an application-specific integrated circuitry, or ASIC, an A-S-I-C. If you go online and you you just Google ASIC Bitcoin miner, you can see that you can actually buy this equipment, and it's actually designed specifically for Bitcoin mining. The closest thing that you can get off the shelf that is similar are the graphics cards. But if you have the budget to go with the ASIC Bitcoin miner, you're going to get far, far more better performance. Now, it's going to chew up more power. So if you can bring solar power generated electricity into this mix and mine during the day while you can,
That'll help.
Feed it with solar. That should help with your profit margin. But it really is a real power hungry sort of thing. And to be quite honest with you, I think that you might be able to make a little bit of money on short term, but I think going long term, the model for crypto is going to go away from what's called proof of work, and the work being the mining, the computationally intensive calculations that you have to do in order to mine Bitcoin. That is a very power hungry way of implementing the blockchain. I think that's going to go away in favor of what's called proof of stake, which is Ethereum is going to be going to proof of stake before long.
What do you mean by Bitcoin mining, John?
Okay, Bitcoin mining, I have to talk a little bit about what a hash is. And the best way to explain this without getting too
geeky technical,
When you open an account online and you create a username and a password, the password is, I guess some people might do it this way, but it's beyond ridiculous at this point. The password is not stored in their database in what's called clear text. And clear text is the characters as you actually type them. The password is converted to what's called a hash. Now, your password could be 8 characters, it could be 12 characters, it could be 15 characters. The hash is always going to be the same number of characters. And it's like encryption, but there's no key and there's no way to decrypt. You can't go from a hash back to the clear text. Or if you try to do it, it would be very, very difficult. And that's what you would need very heavy-duty computational power to do. So mining for Bitcoin is a process called solving a hash. And really, it's not at all different than if you're trying to crack a password by reversing the hash to the original clear text password. And as I say this, it occurs to me I'm probably already geeking it up too much. it's a very complex mathematical algorithm to go from a variable length string of characters to a fixed length string of characters.
John, hold on. We're at the bottom of the half. We're going to come back with final phone calls, and I'll let you wrap up that question when we come back. And welcome back to Coast, our final segment with John Horst. John, why did Bitcoin, not how, but why did Bitcoin get established? To fight off the banks or what? What was the rationale behind it?
I think the financial crisis had a lot to do with it. People don't want to have to trust the central banks, the Fed. People don't want to have to rely on a central authority in order to be able to do trustworthy transactions. And so we go back to what I said in the previous segment about your bank statement. If you look at your bank statement, ask yourself, why do you trust it? Why do you trust that those numbers are right? At the end of the day, the bank has a software package that is supposed to be subject to very strict regulations and audits.
Mm-hmm.
The bank regulators are supposed to be doing their job. Well, we all believe that they were doing their job until 10 years ago when the financial crisis hit, and it became quite clear that the regulators were asleep at the switch. So they told us back then that if the public lost confidence in the banking sector, you know, it would be Armageddon.
Yeah.
No, the people lost faith in the banking sector. The free market went out and created a way to transact business without having to trust the banking sector or a central bank, and that's called the blockchain. So I think it really was a desire to be able to transact business in the economy without having to trust a central authority.
But I would guess that a very few percent might be dealing with the blockchain. I think if you go out and poll 100 people, John, 99 of them don't use Bitcoin. What do you think?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. This, I look back, I kind of try to look at this historically. Go back to when electricity was invented. The vast majority of people didn't have it. Only a few people had it. And our grandparents and the great-grandparents' generation, they saw their world transformed by it. As long as I have been alive, I've taken electricity for granted. I walk in the house, I flip the switch, the light comes on. Now, our children, my children, they're 20 and 18 now. They've never known life without email and cell phones and text messages and social media. I've seen that transformer economy. They've never known life without it. Our grandchildren will never know life without the blockchain. The blockchain is going to transform the way the everyday economy works. It's going to take time, and a lot of things will wash out. Some things will work, other things will fail. I think Bitcoin is going to be a legacy cryptocurrency at some point in something more like Ethereum. There's another coin called NEO, N-E-O, that I think is even better than Ethereum. It has the same smart contract concept. I am firmly convinced that our grandchildren will never know life without the blockchain.
Interesting.
It will eventually transform our economy like the internet.
All right, what a prediction. To the phones now we go again. Let's go to our international line. Mayo in Vancouver, Canada is with us. Hi, Mayo.
Hey, George.
Hi.
I love your show.
Thank you.
This is an awesome topic. This whole business with cybersecurity is a big deal for me.
Oh, huge.
First of all, I would like to say that to you and your guests that one thing that hasn't been discussed about this Facebook breach is that a lot of businesses use Facebook conduct their business. And in the olden days, before the internet, client lists were proprietary. You could get sued for walking away with a client list. And now we've got breaches all over the place, so we don't know who's got our client list, right?
Absolutely.
The second thing was my little experience was I used to work for a market research company, and believe it or not, the security was terrible. This was years ago, okay? But I remember
it's
working
not
on
any, it's not any better today, let me tell you, but go on.
I agree. I talk to IT people all the time, and I hear the same story. Anyways, I'm working away on the computer, and I was filling out some forms, and something was typing stuff into the forms and erasing it as I was working on it. You know, it's like that ICU technology that IT people use to fix your computer. Although this was not an IT person, this was an unknown entity that somehow or other got into our system. So I just thought I'd share that.
Go ahead, John.
You have to be careful even when you open a PDF. PDFs can host what's called JavaScript code. And if you don't really know where that PDF comes from, you don't trust it. And you don't have your antivirus up to date, you can put yourself at risk.
What's happening, John, to a guy's computer? He said he's on his computer and his mouse starts moving all over the screen and he's not even touching it.
Yeah, that would lead me to believe that someone's reaching in there and remote controlling the computer in some way, shape, or form.
Gosh. Now, could you fix it by just unplugging the internet?
Yes, that should be able to fix it, because if you're not hooked up to the internet, then there's no way that they can.
Right, but when you hook back up again, can they come and get you?
Yeah, they could. You would want to unhook it and then
wait a while.
Have somebody take a real long, hard look at whether there's malware that's opened up a path into the computer.
Frank in Hollywood, Maryland is with us. Go ahead, Frank.
Howdy, Joe. Glad to be back with you.
Hi there.
We talk about the hackers and what they do worldwide. We never talk about punishment. Let's make it such that make the punishment such that you don't even think it, let alone do it. And as you alluded to earlier, and when the show started, about these folks getting to 30 years for a crime they didn't do.
Yeah. And he got $1 million out of it, which I don't think is a lot for 31 years.
I did looked at 10 cases last year where six of them got 30 years for four, three got 27, and then the others got 10 to 15. And then when they're exonerated by the governor, DNA and whatnot, when they go for compensation, They tell them to get lost. I'm proposing $1 million a year. If you're in there for 30 years for something you didn't do, $1 million a year after the first 2 years, because I've known a couple of people that went to jail. They'll go to jail for a year to get $1 million. I wouldn't go for 3 days for $1 million. And
if they put you in wrongly, you'd want that million.
Yeah, that's what I was putting there wrongly, but I wouldn't go just for the money.
You're not going to get the money if you're guilty.
No, if I go in there to get for somebody else and they offer me $1 million for a year, I wouldn't take it. Now, the other day I was doing a piece of business, and when I told the company that I didn't have an email, they wouldn't do business with me. Is that crazy or what?
And well, I guess you got to have email nowadays.
Get out of here. I told him, get out of here.
What do you think? How many people are on computers and they have email addresses and everything else? I would say it's a great majority, John. Wouldn't you?
Yeah, I think I saw a statistic. It's in the high 80s, the high 80% now.
And demographically, younger children, gosh, They're all on the internet.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's a really funny story. My 20-year-old, when he was 10, he looked at me at the dinner table and he said, "Dad, did you have email when you were a kid?" my wife was sitting next to me, and I said, "No, your mom and me, we actually wrote love letters to each other in cursive. And then we licked the stamp to put it on the envelope." And he had this disgusted 10-year-old boy look on his face, and you couldn't tell whether it was the licking of the stamp or the love letter part. And then he chewed on that, and he looked at me, and he said, "Well, did you have electricity?" And it's emblematic of, again, they're taking it for granted. They've never known life without it.
On the average, John, how many people text you every day? Different people.
Good Lord. I would say different people on average, I probably get about 10 or 12.
Could you imagine if they were all phone calls? You'd never get anything done.
No, you wouldn't.
People would be calling like crazy. I mean, so
you know, it's funny because as my kids were growing up, you know, when we were growing up, if we got mad at our parents, you know, we might be standing there with a buddy and, you know, might say, "Yeah, my dad is such a jerk. He wouldn't let me go out to this thing." Now the kids, they send that as texts, and it just feels differently when you're reading it on the text. And we went through that with our kids, and I had to tell my wife, I said, "We said these things when we were kids. We just didn't say them with text messages."
Everything's text now with kids. Everything.
Yeah.
Everything. They don't even like talking on the phone. They prefer just to send text. And if they go to dinner together, they've got their smartphones out. They don't even look at each other. And they're texting away to somebody, maybe to each other at the table. Who knows?
They can be in the back seat of the car and they're texting each other. It's ridiculous.
Back and forth. Steve in Connecticut, yeah. Welcome to the show. Steven, go ahead.
Hey, gentlemen, of course, if that mouse is moving around, it's a paranormal thing. Then plugging the internet won't help.
That could be.
I got two quick points. I don't know if you heard recently, according to Edward Snowden, the NSA is now able to track the Bitcoin currency. And it should be interesting to see how many arrests may be made because the underworld is known to use between, you know, drugs and gun trafficking and things of that nature. I don't know if you heard anything about that or not.
Yeah. I'm not in the least bit surprised by that.
Yeah. The other point I just wanted to point out, you're talking about the medical stuff. Understand you do not have to give your social security number to the medical staff. That's only used for billing type things if they go into collections. But if they ever get hacked or whatever, they could actually, you know, get your information through that. So I just want to put that as a public service.
Okay, yep, good.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Steve.
Yeah,
appreciate that.
Let's talk a little bit about Bitcoin and NSA. There is a method called chain analysis. This is it's very sophisticated statistics. They will take the blockchain and then they will look at metadata surrounding other internet activity that comes out of the same device, and they will be able to figure out who's behind that wallet ID. It's not like a 100% certain thing, but it has been used in money laundering court cases, so it's good enough for criminal prosecution. So people need to understand you are not anonymous on the blockchain, and don't let anybody tell you otherwise.
Good point. Next up, Al's in Erie, Pennsylvania. Hello, Al. Go ahead.
Hey, good evening, George and John. How are you both?
Hi, good. Thank you, Al.
Very good. Thank you. Now, you know what? I'm going to make two statements, and then I'm going to ask John a question.
All right.
Our kids today are socially inept. Just socially inept because of social media and all the technology that we've developed. Number two is never forget what Thomas Jefferson said about central banks. Those are my two statements. John, here's the question for you. When you were talking about the conversion from clear text to hash and back again, and you also mentioned power generation and also solar power,
yep.
Does that have to maintain your current line voltage and current to prevent the interference of the conversion of hash back to clear text? For instance, if your line voltage dropped to 10 of a volt, would that interfere with the conversion?
I don't know the answer to that question. I'm not entirely certain that I know the answer to that question. I don't believe it does.
What does that question mean, John? What's hash and conversion mean?
Oh, okay, well, when we talk about clear text to hash is like, it is just, well, if you looked at a hash, it would look like a random string of characters. If you were to then go, you put that random string of characters in a database, the next time you log in, you enter your password, that website is going to hash your password and check the hash against what it saved in the database. And if it matches, then your password matches. This way, if someone hacks into the database, they don't see your actual password. They see this random string of characters that is the hash of your password. Now, if they wanted to figure out what your password was, they could run it through the same basic kind of equipment that's used for Bitcoin mining. And depending on the strength of the algorithm, it could take anywhere from a couple hours to a month's worth of computing to figure out what the clear text was from that hash. And so you can use, and this is one of the important takeaways, is you can use a Bitcoin miner as a password cracker. And if you notice that systems, they ask people to make longer and more complicated passwords now, where you have to have a lowercase letter, an uppercase letter, a number, a special character. This is designed to make it harder for a password cracking piece of equipment to brute force through the hash and figure out what the clear text was and then compromise your credentials. In a lot of systems, you have to change your password every 60 days for the same.
Quick question, John, before we wrap up. When Jobs and Wozniak came up with a personal computer, Had we had the internet then?
When they came up with the personal computer, there was a system called the ARPANET, and that was the Advanced Research Projects Agency of the DOD. The ARPANET is the predecessor to the internet.
But it was not widespread at that time.
No, absolutely not. It was just a research. It was DOD and academic researchers networking their
computers. All right. Hey, thank you, John, for being on the program. Really appreciate it. John Horse taking us through cybersecurity. Up next, we're going into the dream world. Stick around.